This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. A new composition debuting at the Cape Cod Chamber Music Festival this week blends the sound of a traditional string quintet with the notes of ancient Neanderthal bone flutes played by none less than a local marine biologist. We've got a sneak preview for you. And we're nearing the end of peak Lyme disease season, what you should know about symptoms and some innovative research on long-term treatment options. First, though, a climate science report leaked to the New York Times this past week presents some unsettling warnings about our changing weather here in New England, as well as our current political climate nationwide. That report is part of the fourth National Climate Assessment. These assessments are intended to provide guidance to lawmakers and officials from federal to local. Jerry Melillo was one of the editors of the last National Climate Assessment in 2014. He's a distinguished scientist, and that's a formal term, and director emeritus of the Ecosystem Center at the Marine Biological Laboratory here in Woods Hole. He joins me now to talk about how the science and the politics of climate change has shifted in the past few years and where this National Climate Assessment might be headed. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Heather, thank you very much. Good to be here.
Let's start with the science. I mean, the last National Climate Assessment, and we should say this is basically dozens of scientists, mostly federal employees, putting together a synthesis of all the climate science that's out there. Last one came out in 2014. How much has changed in 3 years in terms of what the science is actually telling us about the impacts of climate change?
Well, I think the key messages remain consistent between 2014 and now. And they are, first of all, that climate is changing. Secondly, humans are primarily responsible for those changes. And thirdly, humans can do something about the climate in the future, reducing greenhouse gas emissions, slowing the rate of climate change, and hopefully ultimately reversing the rate of climate change.
Now, these reports, a lot of effort goes into what may seem like nitpicking. There's very formal language about certainty and likelihood and, you know, are we 90 or 95 or 99% certain that, you know, that humans are causing climate change, or, you know, how likely is it that this is going to be the impact? Are we just steadily moving in the direction of greater certainty and greater likelihood? Is there any science that's been coming out that, you know, drops any of our confidence or certainty in any of these outcomes?
No, I think we're progressively moving to greater certainty. We're also moving to greater resolution about what we can say in a spatial sense about climate change and the texture that it has across the nation and across the world.
Well, that's really one of the main points of these assessments, or at least the last one. And now this one is not just saying global impacts or even nationwide impacts, but breaking the U.S. down into these different regions and really trying to hone in as the science has gotten better. We can start to hone in and say, well, we're going to see different impacts in the Northeast than we're going to see in California. And this report actually highlights the fact that the Northeast is already feeling some of the stronger impacts of climate change.
Exactly. I think one of the strengths of the last assessment and this one is the attention paid to the differences in regional experiences with climate change. For example, the Northeast has been experiencing exceptionally high numbers of extreme precipitation events.
Right. We had that crazy storm a few weeks ago and the flooding. And all you have to do is talk to any gardener and they'll tell you, you know, spring is no longer a few steady rainstorms. It's downpours and dry and downpours and dry.
Exactly. And I remember in, I think it was 2010, I was driving home from Yale to Woods Hole in the evening when it was late in the spring, when there was a tremendous downpour that closed Route 95 just as I was driving through. And I was behind a 14-wheeler in my little Subaru. And the only way I got through is that he made a wake and I was able to travel through with him.
Driving in someone's wake is not what you expect on a road.
Exactly.
Yeah. One thing that is highlighted very early in this latest report, you know, the last one came out in 2014, and then 2014 was declared the warmest year on record.
And then 2015 was warmer than 2014, and 2016 was warmer than 2015.
Exactly.
And it looks like 2017 is headed in the same direction, that is, continuing the record.
As a climate scientist looking at that, can we dismiss that as, you know, one-offs, you're going to have warmest years on record so often? I mean, what does that say to you when you see 4 years in a row, each the warmest on record? And are we seeing an acceleration of the process?
Well, again, I think for climate scientists, putting those years in a larger record is absolutely critical. So if we go back, say, two decades, 16 of the last 17 years were the sequentially the warmest years that we've observed in record history. And going back further than that, this particular assessment traces things back to 1901 and uses the period 1901 to 1960 kind of as a reference period against which they're evaluating everything that happens subsequently. So long-term records are really essential. Some climate scientists say if you don't have a 30-year record, you're going to be in trouble because you can't interpret things very well. But fortunately, we have quite long-term records, and they're tremendously helpful.
And one of the other big picture things that comes out of looking at that record in this report is that we have already warmed global average, talking global averages here, about 1 degree Celsius. Now, the Paris Agreement and generally kind of the goal of international climate policy and negotiations has been to limit warming to between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. So we're already half to two-thirds of the way there. And one of the conclusions of this report is that even if we leveled off greenhouse gases in the atmosphere right now, which basically means going cold turkey, we'd probably hit 1.5 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. Got so it. You said one of the messages is that we can do something about it. That almost argues that we can't, doesn't it?
Well, let me give you two perspectives. I'm not so sanguine about the 1.5 to 2 degree increase. I mean, we're already seeing effects of climate change now.
Meaning you think that those are already too lenient.
Those are lenient. And what we have to look at, however, is the art of the possible. And the sooner we can take action, the more likely it is that we're going to be able to keep climate change under some level of control, whether it's going to be 1.5, which I think is a real reach, 2, which is a reach, or something above that. If we don't get started now, it's only going to be that much more difficult. And, you know, there are two things that we think about. We think about mitigation, the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions as one of the responses. But as you point out, there's some baked-in climate change already given past emissions, and therefore adaptation becomes an important factor. That is, the kinds of things that we can do to avoid the worst of the consequences of climate change. And adaptation is going to get harder and harder as the temperature rises to a point where in many situations it may not be enough, particularly coastal areas, for example, with sea level rise. One of the interesting things about this report that you may have noticed is that the upper level of sea level rise now projected for the end of the century is 2 feet higher than we projected in the 2014 National Climate Assessment. So it's up to the very high level projection is over 8 feet mean sea level rise. And that is really sobering.
That's scary.
And one of the reasons for that projection increase is that scientists are feeling they're getting a better understanding of the dynamics of the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica and how they might respond to warming. And the fact is, I think most scientists will agree, we've been pretty conservative about predicting the rate of melt of those major water bodies. And if the rates continue as they appear to be increasing, the 8-foot sea level rise is something that is within the realm of possibility.
In case you're just joining us, we're talking about the climate science report leaked to the New York Times this past week. Jerry Melillo edited the previous climate assessment. Jerry, this really is a political story as much as a science story, because, of course, you're talking about, from the science community's perspective, the science getting more and more certain, and in fact, the impacts becoming clearer and the predictions becoming more dire, while in the political realm, much of the Trump administration continues to deny that carbon dioxide is creating climate change and that we have any problem. The process of creating this report that was leaked a few days ago actually began under President Obama. You've been in contact with some of the, you know, authors and scientists working on this report. Was there a change in the process or anything that kind of happened after the election or after the inauguration to change the process of creating this assessment report?
To the best of my knowledge, and this derives from discussions with a number of the authors of the special report on climate science, to date, there has been no change. What they're worried about is the report seeing the light of day in the end, because the process involves not only the writing of the report, having it extensively reviewed. And by the way, the National Academy of Sciences did an extensive review of this report, and the review was very positive. But then the report is submitted to the White House, normally OSTP.
The Office of Science, Technology, Policy.
Office of Science and Technology Policy. Within the White House, there is currently no director of that office who usually is the recipient of the report. The Office of Science and Technology Policy does its own review for the quality of the science. Once that is done, then the president usually passes the report along to Congress. And Congress is the ultimate audience for this report because it was legislated in 1990 that these reports be periodically produced. And the climate science report is part of a larger national climate assessment effort that is ongoing with the hopes that it will be finished around the end of the year.
Well, and this particular part of the report, that approval process, that final approval process is supposed to be wrapping up this week by August 18th.
Exactly.
So, you know, you see where the timing potentially for the leak, we don't know who leaked it or exactly what was in their mind, but that's the presumption is that it was concern that wouldn't go ahead. But on the other hand, UN Ambassador Nikki Haley has said that she doesn't see any reason why this shouldn't proceed. So is this, you know, a paranoid action? Is this overly cautious to think that this might be suppressed in some way?
Well, my perception is it's belt and suspenders. People are really wanting to make sure that there is a benchmark document that says this is what we, the scientists, 50 or so, who participated in this activity, produced. Now, whatever comes out the other end, you'll have a chance to look at the original product and whatever comes out of the White House at the end of their approval process. And scientists want to make sure that the public, in a very transparent way, has their own chance to see how they compare. And I must say, the report has maintained something that we started in the last assessment, and that is a component called traceable accounts, so that for all of the major conclusions that are drawn in the report, and they're fairly nicely laid out in the executive summary of the report in little green boxes, for all of those conclusions, you can go back and look at the data that the scientists who wrote the report used to get to those conclusions. And so it is an attempt to be totally transparent. And I think this releasing of the report by, I don't know who did it, but by someone, was an attempt to make sure that that transparency continued through the entire process, including the public release in the end by the White House.
As you said, this special science report is kind of at the heart of the entire national climate assessment. It's the science that then the other parts build on. Assuming that everything goes forward according to plan, and we get a full fourth national climate assessment 2018, Where does that go from there? Who uses it and how? Do you have examples maybe from the last one of how that's actually been put into action?
A large number of them, in fact. We specifically tried to engage not only government at various levels, local, state, regional entities, but also other users, practitioners such as people responsible for supplying water to the city of Seattle, businesses involved in the agricultural sector. They are all users of this information, and they particularly appreciate that traceable accounts that I mentioned, because if they look at a conclusion and they're not sure, they can go back and do their own checking. The other thing that happened during the third National Climate Assessment was the creation of a network of potential users. It was referred to as NACANET, the National Climate Assessment Network, that has as members, and it's still active, people from the business community, people from NGOs, people from academia, and all of the resource management types that you can imagine across the country. And so they have been interacting with each other using the information we reported in the third National Climate Assessment, and then advising us as to the additional information they wanted in the fourth National Climate Assessment. And so the fourth assessment is going to be somewhat expanded, and it's going to have a very important region-by-region focus. And by the way, the government took seriously the sub-regional interests. That when we produced the third National Climate Assessment, we heard from a lot of congressmen from various states wanting historical data about their state, not just the region their state was in. And that has been now provided through the good services of NOAA. And so this is going to be particularly valuable for people at the state and sub-state level.
Jerry Melillo is a distinguished scientist and director emeritus of the Ecosystem Center at the Marine Biological Laboratory. He edited the previous National Climate Assessment. Jerry, thanks for sharing your perspective.
Heather, you're most welcome.
Up next, innovative research on Lyme disease. That's when Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.